rhythm is the soul of our life. It's added to the song to make it more elaborate, more vital, and have tremendous force with it.
This is an audio guide to Drum Listens to Heart, Part 3. Drum Listens to Heart is a multi-part exhibition spread over 7 months that explores percussion as an aesthetic and political notion. It takes place at the Waters Institute in San Francisco from September 1st, 2022 to March 4th, 2023. This is the third installment of the exhibition. Drum Listens to Heart weaves together various forms of percussion, some physical and socio-political, others literal and metaphorical. Together, the works juxtapose instances of physical impact and vibration with forms of command, emancipation, and community building. This audio guide will provide deeper insight into each artwork and its relationship with the percussive as an aesthetic and practical concept. Our chief curator,
Anthony Huberman,
will chime in along the way. If you want to know more about each artwork and the exhibition as a whole, pick up our brochure or peruse the catalog at the front desk. To dig even deeper, our website, waters.org, has a library of video interviews with artists and curators about this exhibition and exhibitions past. For a full list of performances and programs for Drum Listens to Heart, visit waattis.org for more information about upcoming lectures, conversations, and performances, as well as our pop-up record shop. Drum listens to heart. Though the three-part structure of the exhibition can be conceived of as a single show, this third and final chapter brings together the vocabulary built through previous iterations into a single space.
The exhibition did something. It went somewhere. It began someplace, but then as we spent our life with it, as we interacted with it, even my own way of thinking about it evolved. This three-part structure ended up being much more important than I initially thought. I thought people would experience them and consider them three completely separate exhibitions, and the vast majority of people would only see one. And it's been great to see that that's actually not the case. And a lot of people have appreciated the way in which that structure really echoes the drum as something that repeats, the drum of something that happens in time.
David Hammonds is the first artist you'll encounter after opening the doors to the final installment of Drum Listens to Heart.
Hammonds was one of the origin points of my interest in even thinking about percussion.
The untitled work comprises a basketball, a tree trunk with a basketball hoop attached, and dirt from Harlem in New York City.
Rare piece for Hammonds, which is an instruction piece. Many works in his career have been the series of basketball prints. Dirt taken from where he's from and where he lives, and transfers this materiality from it that is coded with a particular community, a particular racial, social, economic community, and kind of moving it onto and insisting and making its mark known and presence felt in the space of the framed painting on the wall.
The Waters walls are covered in prints of the basketball, made by covering the ball in Harlem earth and bouncing it against the wall repeatedly. Though the act of bouncing a ball against a surface is indisputably percussive, its tie to percussion goes even deeper.
It's not a drawing on paper, but it's directly on the wall. And so it's taking this material and really inhabiting and making sure that where he is from, again, in all senses of the word, are physically being stamped into existence, stamps into presence in this place that it's not where he's from. But yet his presence is done in his abstract. It's not by putting his name everywhere or his picture of his face everywhere. It's via this abstract mark making in the language of drawing, which is about mark making, or prints, which is about mark making.
The video piece Gong is the second Hammonds piece in the room. The single channel video shows a construction crew of jackhammers and other cacophonous machinery working away while Hammonds accompanies them from the sidewalk with a gong.
You see a construction crew working on a sidewalk in New York City, opening up the sidewalk in order to obviously get at some kind of pipes or tunnels below. And most people cover your ears or just kind of walk faster as you walk by. But Hammonds doesn't do that. And he appears in the background with a gong. And he essentially just joins in, and he turns that crew of construction workers into an ensemble, into an orchestra.
By bringing in an instrument found in arguably traditional music settings, Hammonds frames the construction work as a type of music, which creates curiosity instead of hostility for the types of everyday cacophony we might encounter.
there's a connection again between this notion of taking what is there and diverting it or rerouting it.
Through Hammons's framework, we might ask, what kinds of ensembles can we create when we reframe a racket? What so-called instrument would you bring to the noise symphony? Nick Kaye's interdisciplinary approach to filmmaking entwines diasporic performers and performances that often center around a crucial element of Black culture, joy. Their work as a performer and choreographer leaks into their video work as Kaye explores how a beat can make its way into our body and, in turn, how we put that beat back out into the world.
As they were talking more about the relationship between the body and movement, it not only, of course, struck me that dance is something that I absolutely wanted to include in this show. You can't do a show related to drumming and not have dancing. I mean, the two belong together in so many ways.
One form of table drumming speaks to another across the room. Shared rhythms unite the diasporic experiences on screen.
One of the things that they connected to with percussion was their own kind of childhood memories of people in the classroom communicating and maybe also competing with, or just kind of engaging in the social ritual between classmates of table drumming as a practice or as a performance.
Pause here to experience Nick Kaye's multimedia installation. In the next room, we'll discuss scores and language through the works of Consuelo Tupa Hernandez and Raven Chacon. Consuelo Tupa Hernandez is often preoccupied with how signs and symbols operate within social norms. Her applause dictionary, here presented as inkjet prints adhered to the wall, defined different types of applause. Though the action of applauding is the same each time, slapping one hand against the other, the meaning and often sonic experience of the applause depends heavily on a shared understanding of why one would or should clap.
Where she wrote a dictionary for all the different kinds of applause. It's an act or a gesture that all of us recognize. There are dozens of meanings. There's the enthusiastic clap that signifies being impressed. There's the ironic clap that signifies being skeptical. Same gesture the whole time. It's just clapping hands together. And yet there's this immense range. So she wrote a dictionary entry pretending as if they're actually completely separate acts. You need a whole dictionary in order to be able to explain to people what this refers to. So the room is almost surrounded in the way that you'd be surrounded by applause.
Raven Chacon's graphic score, American Legend No. 1, printed on an army blanket, lays out a performance where the participants might reenact, through Chacon's instructions, the story of the founding of the so-called United States. Like any score, there is room for musicians, or performers of any sort, to interpret Chacon's story of the United States' establishment through their own framework, which depends heavily on their relationship to the story found in history textbooks. Both Hernandez and Chacon's pieces are scores in that they abstract a type of language or gesture connoting communication.
Two forms of language, basically. One of them is abstract because it is. And there's so many words, it just ends up becoming a big blur of language. And then that surrounding this score for a performance. So the applause, in a way, is surrounding the performance, which is presented in the same room. And the performance is, of course, not a performance, but is the score for a performance, which itself is also this abstract language, an abstract notation. Consuelo is using the English language to make a notation for a sound. And Raven is using a different type of notation as a way to inscribe a particular musical composition. And so I felt that those two types of language, types of writing, were a great combination.
Pause here to read over Chacon's score and Hernandez's dictionary. You're welcome to take a page if it resonates with you. In the next room, we'll discuss immanence in David Zinke's photographs and Guadalupe Maravilla's sculptures, as well as the tap, tap, tapping of Rie Nakajima's small works. This third room is full of always about to happen. Guadalupe Maravilla's disease throwers boasting their large gongs that could be struck. The feet in David Zinke's photographs about to return to the ground. Maravilla's sculptures take up considerable space. Like a mythic beast, the sculptures reach up and over our heads, perhaps threatening to take us in.
So on one hand, maravillas are these altar pieces, referral back to the Milford Graves that began the exhibition. Milford begins it and Maravilla ends it. And both of them to me felt like these sacred objects.
Born in El Salvador, Maravilla escaped the Salvadorian Civil War by migrating to the United States alone at 8 years old. Maravilla imagines the sculptures as healing tools, not just for disease, famine, and war brought on by colonization, but as literal healing instruments that brought the artist comfort during his personal battles with illness.
Healing because it's something that Guadalupe himself experienced as someone who survived cancer thanks to all kinds of alternative treatments, including sound bath. Each of the sculptural elements are objects that represent different parts of his journey as he was a migrant coming from Central America through Mexico and across the border into the United States. And he revisited those places, and that's where those materials all come from.
Now more widely known and accepted in the West as an alternative healing practice, sound baths are meditative experiences where the attendees are bathed in the vibration of sound. In a religious or spiritual ceremony, like Sunday in a Baptist church, or the shamanistic drum rituals we saw in Luke Engahadluk's Prince in Part 1, a beat, rhythm, or pulse can lead a group to another psychic state. Except with a sound bath, there is no repetition or beat. The gong's sustained vibration created through light impact takes over the body and mind. When not being played, the disease throwers still ring in the room, as David Zinke's triptych photographs can't help but make a thud while viewers stare and anticipate the two elevated feet returning suddenly to earth.
David Zinke is where the body is. There's that kind of absence-presence play that happens there.
Both of these works are about to percuss, about to make impact.
And then there's a magic to both of them, right? There's magical nature to these kind of disease throwers, that they can magically get rid of disease and maravilla. And David Zinke, are they levitating? Are they falling down? Are these bodies in some kind of ceremony, a ritual? All of them, you know, refer to the fact that they're all about to percuss. They're all about to make impact.
You may have noticed Rie Nakajima's small kinetic sculptures percussing against the far wall in the third gallery. A sound artist and musician, Nakajima's sculpture work, Keru Otu, or Sound Returning, fills the gallery with almost imperceptible, repetitive mechanical noises.
We've touched on spirituality in different ways. We've touched on the body in different ways. And Rie, for me, builds on this very basic notion that to percuss means to hit, means to strike. You know, something that got touched on with an artist like Barry LeVay, or with the hammer piece by Lee Lozano, for example, in the first part.
Unlike other works in the show that have pondered the percussive nature of a machine's incessant repetition, such as Michael E. Smith's Laser and Sweater, Nakajima's almost unassuming sculptures emphasize the orchestra of mechanics experienced in everyday life through everyday objects.
There's another way of building on like these kinetic sculptures that are just pushing a little tin can against a wall over and over again, allowing a little plastic rod to hit against a little stone, which makes the stone like hit up against a beam. And I imagine them like kind of crickets tapping on different parts of the wall up high, down below, these small little insect-like presence of constant pecking, but them not being animal, them all being machinic. I also really like the contrast between all these insect-like sounds in the same room as these huge maravilla sculptures. What can we accompany these major maravilla sculptures with? And it felt like this can also be something that can kind of formally complement that gallery.
Pause here. When we return in the fourth and final room, I invite you to adorn yourself with Hegu Yang's sonicware. The theme of imminence continues in Hegu Yang's wearable bell sculptures, that is, until you put them on and assume the duties or attitude of a living bell. Visitors may wear the bell sculptures and become an instrument in the exhibition. You are the drum, choosing how to interact with other visitors, artworks, and the architecture of the space.
You know, the relationship between percussion and bells and the spiritual realm is one that has a long history to it. The drum and sometimes the bell is a tool one uses in a ritualistic context, be able to open the door to be able to learn from and hear from a spiritual realm.
Yang's pieces give agency to the visitor to use the bell's sounds, in the same way Davina Samos' collection of bells put the power in visitors' hands to decide on what occasion a bell should ring. Yang's sonicware draws influence from the tradition of Korean shamanism, a women-led folk religion stifled by the arrival of the Catholic Church in South Korea during the Joseon Dynasty period. Though Yang is not recreating shamanistic bells, sonicware points to the potential of a bell or beat to bring people together in the spiritual realm.
In the Venus case, it was more about a bell as a signaling device. In Hegyu's case, the bell is much more of a ritualistic device. It plays a major role in rituals specific to different forms of Korean shamanism that Hegyu is very interested in.
Yang sculptures require the cooperation of a full body to operate, as percussion must have proximity to the body to reach a spiritual plane. The table where the bells rest is surrounded by a vibrant wallpaper meant to contextualize the bells as an offering.
She said, you know, one of the important parts of shamanism is that there are these physical displays, which are part of the customs of when you gather in the context of these rituals. There's oftentimes a table with a series of offerings on them that are filled with all kinds of different things. And so she made this incredible backdrop, which is a kind of psychedelic, almost as if comes from the place where you might, your imagination might go, or your spirit might go when it's on a kind of trance-like shamanistic journey. That's what's so interesting about this exhibition is that we've established a set of terms, themes, temperatures, maybe, as the iterations happen. It's almost like some are louder and quieter than others. And what's beautiful is that that works differently for different people. All three parts somehow ensemble all the different themes. All of them touch on the body. All of them touch on impact or strike or hit. You know, all of them touch on the spiritual. All of them touch on the political. All of them touch on sense of community building. Part three, the sense of ritual is what emerges a lot. Whether a ritual is in the context of a spiritual ritual or a social ritual, like these different forms of organizing human experiences and how percussion is so active within that.
Thank you for listening to the audio guide to Drum Listens to Heart, Part 3. I invite you now to peruse the record shop located in the Wattis Bar behind Room 3. There, you'll find an eclectic history of percussion as told by the selection of records which were curated by local shops and record collectors. To locate more resources about Drum Listens to Heart, including audio guides to Part 1 and 2, visit wattis.org. And now, Babatunde Olatunji's ensemble will play us out.